Now, Sir Stanley, I'd like you to go back in your memory to around about the First World War and tell us about how things were in Edinburgh before the outbreak of the First World War, round about 1912, 1913.
But I gave that a touch. Yes.
At that period, have you any memories of how the faculty was administered and what sort of accommodation did the staff have?
Yes, I've got, funnily enough, though, I've got a very poor memory. That's one of the things that I remember inside out. I remember to this day climbing that golden stair in the quadrangle of the new buildings and going up to where the Faculty of Medicine meets and the room that's called the Dean's Room now was the total administrative center of the whole faculty, that one small room, presided over by one little man in spectacles called Mr. Buckle, who was there for 30 years, and two typists. That was the whole staff. I suppose the present staff would be 25. Well, I take it that that because of the efficiency of Dr. Duncan and these other people, it's necessary to have this big staff because of the different duties they have to do with the health services and the hospitals and the vast expansion that has occurred in the medical school. Yes. In those days, every department of the Faculty of Medicine was confined to that one quadrangle. The whole lot. There was nothing outside it. That's to say that your department, which didn't exist then, and bacteriology, would consist of about four or five rooms and laboratories. And the staff of the bacteriology department, when I joined it, you see, was a professor who was dead, one lecturer and two assistants. Now, I suppose he has a staff of perhaps 15 or 20, and you may have a staff of 30 or 40, for all I know, when Lorraine Smith. But the duties are so entirely different now, and with the planning of these enormous extensions different departments, that I can quite see why you need a very much bigger administrative staff.
It's surprising that the whole administration was carried out in one small room.
In one small
room. The Dean's room, at the top of the stairs, yes. Where you turn right and yes, you go into that little room.
That's the only thing.
And Mr. Buckle must have been a very efficient man. He sounds to me as though he would have a terribly important job. Do you remember him at all?
Oh, very well. Yes. I've known him for 30 years. But I don't know that he had a very difficult job. He really did nothing but take our names and see that we were matriculated.
Yes.
The faculty really didn't have anything to do with the Royal Infirmary other than with the appointment of the professors and on staff appointments. But they'd absolutely nothing to do with running any hospital at all. And so Mr. Buckle's duties were really quite limited. He's just looking after that one quadrangle and seeing once a year that people were matriculated.
But running the undergraduate teaching program must have called for a lot of coordination.
Yes, well, probably according to our friend Robson, he says the coordination that I brought back, was he still thinks was the best they've ever had and still thinks it's the best. Well, it was done, of course, by a committee of professors, not by Mr. Buckle, the dean, the part-time dean, and even he took very little part. He was just a medical jurisprudent. The person, somebody like myself, really was responsible for that sort of work. I brought in the timetable where when, you know, I was lecturing on typhoid, you were doing the pathology of the gut and so on, and the people in the Royal Infirmary were giving clinical lectures. I still think that was a very good arrangement, and I don't see how it could be bettered. Yeah. And Robson says that still.
Yes. You mentioned that the pathology department did not exist in Teviot Place at that time.
Oh, yes, it did, but not for doing routine pathology.
Ah.
It existed for teaching students. It just consisted of Lorraine Smith's own room and one or two laboratories, and a lecture theatre. Yes. All the pathology was done in the Royal Infirmary from, you know where I mean, the day-to-day stuff. Yes.
He didn't do much day-to-day pathology, Lorraine Smith, I believe.
Oh, no, nothing at all.
None at all?
Nothing. Well, I never don't think so. That chap who was a senior lecturer there for 30 years did it all. I've forgotten what his name was. He died about 5 or 10 years ago.
Yes.
He was a head pathologist in the Royal.
Not Ogilvy?
Ogilvy, yes.
Yes.
His department in the Royal.
Yes.
So it was normally under Lorraine Smith. They did all the routine
pathology. That did it all. Yes. Yes. That's interesting.
Some routine bacteriology started in the quadrangle when Mackie came back, but only a very small fraction of the total. The main mass again was done at the Royal.
Did you have much contact with Lorraine Smith at
did
all?
Did I? Oh, I knew him very well.
Yes.
Well, you see, I actually joined the Department of Bacteriology, but I didn't mean to. I'd won the gold medal in pathology, and I'd agreed to go be assistant to Lorraine Smith. And Ritchie, I don't know how he persuaded Lorraine Smith that I was to come to him.
Yes.
But I really didn't intend to be a bacteriologist as much as a pathologist.
What was your opinion of Lorraine Smith?
Oh, well, he was a very nice, gentle, quiet, very quiet man. He was a very, very able, clever, nice man. Couldn't say a nasty thing to anybody. Oh, very nice man. Very distinguished chap, I think he was. Very nice. Quite different from Mac. He didn't have the drive, but he was a very, very able, very nice man. I liked him very much.
An unusual situation for him, not taking part in hospital pathology and being sequestered across on the other side of Middle Meadow Walk.
That was quite true, but of course he was quite interested in research.
Yes.
Therefore, I think he was quite happy not to be bothered with it.
Yes.
I don't think it had worried him.
Now, can we just return to this business of how the faculty was before the First World War? You've told us about the administrative staff and the room that they occupied and Mr. Buckle.
Yes.
But
and the dean, of course, was always, for generations, the professor of forensic medicine.
That's right.
And he only lectured in the summer occasionally, so he had no work to do. And he presided at the faculty. But when we had meetings with the faculty, professor, like Sidney Smith, presided at the meetings of the faculty.
That must have been about the time of Harvey Littlejohn and Sidney
Smith.
Well,
Harvey Littlejohn was his immediate predecessor.
Yes.
But Sidney Smith was dean for about 20 years,
yes.
And so was Harvey Littlejohn. The difference between Sidney Smith and Harvey Littlejohn was that whereas Harvey Littlejohn had practically nothing to do because he weren't joined up with the health services, Sidney Smith had a great deal to do, a great amount of administrative work, because we had joined up. And all these changes, when I got these 7 units at the northern group of hospitals, could never have taken place if it hadn't been for Sidney Smith cooperating with me and the Medical Officer of Health.
Yes.
He played a very important part in Edinburgh medicine, Sidney Smith.
He was a very witty man.
Very witty, very delightful man.
Yes.
Very, very able.
Yes.
He's a very good medical Jew. He's the man who got the murder of the Sirdar in Egypt. You remember the story?
I remember, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
He took about 10,000 rifles in and worked out the battling until he found the right bullet.
Yes.
Well, but perhaps the most difference between 1912 and 1917 was fact was that the University of Edinburgh was an imperial university. Now, of these men that I've told you, the hundreds that get qualified, and also a large proportion of the 100 or so in the extramural school, at least 20% came from overseas, because it wasn't till way back about 45 or later, before the universities in Australia, South Africa, New Zealand, and so forth, could grant medical degrees, and that was true of English universities. Quite a lot of English people came to us because they couldn't get degrees because the university to which they belonged only taught up to anatomy and physiology. But this entrance into Edinburgh of this variegated people from India, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, very few from Canada because they had one, made it different to what the university has ever been before or since.
In your own class, before the First World War, looking back on your fellow students, would you say the majority of them came from outside Britain?
No, I would say that about 20 or 30% came from outside Britain, and then perhaps 10% from England and 50% from Scotland. But these outsiders were older than the Scottish students. They were wealthier, and they were much tougher and more experienced men. They liked boozing more, fighting with anybody they'd fight. And they were very good at games. That era of 1910 to 1925 was the era when Edinburgh University could beat any team in Scotland at anything, because we had so many internationals from overseas as students. We've never been the same since.
The South Africans had a very good rugger team.
Very good.
For years, yes.
Oh, very good. So did the New Zealanders.
Yes.
And then we had people from Northern Ireland. We had several internationals from them. So it fairly leveled. It did a lot of good, I think, to the university. Especially to a person like myself, I happened to be very good at games, you see. And so I knew the best of them, because I used to play in these teams, in three different teams I played in the first 15 and so on. And they made lifelong friends, you know. But they were a pretty tough lot. But that it used to be the joke that people said, how was it that such alcoholic fighting creatures, well, one day were boozing away and making beasts themselves, and 2 years later were most respectable doctors? Nobody can understand it. Today you could easily understand it because they're most respectable students. But they weren't respectable, the medical students, you know, of 1912. But nothing was respectable. You couldn't walk along the streets of Edinburgh in 1910 and 12 and find a sober man on a Saturday night. Not only students, you could find nobody sober. Everybody was drunk. Awful.
Did you have many chronic students at that time?
Probably more than we had now. I think we had about 5 or 10% that just went on and on and on. Some were given money as long as they were students. Didn't want to qualify. As long as they were students, they could draw allowance from abroad.
So I think these colourful characters gave some variety to the scene.
Oh, yes. It's never been the same. But, of course, it's a much more sedate and good lot of people now. They were rather a lot of scullywags, most of us. But they did make it colourful, and that was one of the good things they did when we got up to 25 females in 1920, whatever it was. They had a very good influence on the class. We settled down. We were always swearing and cursing and annoying everybody in the classes, you know.
But what sort of attitude did the students have towards women in classes? Edinburgh doesn't have a very good or edifying record as regards women in medicine.
The very worst, but of course it was long ago before that. These women that I remember now, I remember them very well in that class I was teaching in 1921. They were rather like the girls you see at St. Andrews now, much better class than their men. And some of them were very good looking. I remember three of them we all fell in love with. And the result was that they were greatly liked and greatly respected and did a terrific lot of good to these tough sort of colonial people, you know.
They had a civilizing influence.
Well, they did. Yes, very. Yes. I've never forgotten the difference it made. That's just because they were exceptionally nice women.
My aunt was one of these women. She would have been, if she'd lived, about 77 now. And she used to tell me about the lectures she had in Edinburgh in those days and how women were very much in a minority.
Yes.
Now, did you enjoy your undergraduate days in medicine?
Well, I only had a year and a bit at Edinburgh. Mm. And then I had very bad luck. I only had a year and a bit at Cambridge. Mm. You see, when the June 1914 We had a final meeting. I was in the third year at Cambridge, and the whole class attended, and it was obvious that the war was bound to come, and we were under the false idea, like the people were in the last war, that we'd have to hurry up if we were going to beat the Kaiser before New Year. And the whole class agreed to give up medical studies and join combatant units. And so we all did, and when the day war broke out, I jumped on a motorbike with a Cambridge student and joined the Gordon Highlanders. And by 1916, I hadn't one living person in that class at Cambridge alive, not one.
All wiped out.
All wiped out. And I'm the only surviving officer alive of that battalion of Gordon Highlanders in the whole of Britain, myself. I'm the only one. I wrote and asked about it, and I'm the only survivor.
Where was it that you were so severely wounded?
What part of my body?
No, in what part of
the
war was
it? On the apes, on these attacks in 1915. Yes. But you've no idea the misery of the trench life in 14. We were in shoes up to here in mud and water, and the dead were lying about unburied between the two lines, and there was lice and the rats and the smell. And every day people were killed, you know, by snipers up in rafters. And then when it dried up a bit, we thought, now it'll get better, we'll have some decent attacks and show them something. The Germans were twice as efficient as us. They had properly constructed dugouts. When they went off duty, they were made to work. When we went off duty, we did nothing. So that in a battle like Neuve Chapelle, though 1,200 guns sprayed the German lines all night, I never heard such a row. It was nearly all shrapnel. Didn't do the slightest bit of good. The minute the whistle went and we all climbed over the top and went charging across as flat as this, the Germans jumped out of their dugouts, put up the machine guns. We lost 600 men in 1 hour. Absolutely hopeless. And it went on again and again. It was a terrible sight, you know. It's one of the facts that altered my whole life, that war, you know. Because I never did any work before the war. I was too good at games. I just enjoyed myself. But I returned, it completely altered my life.
So obviously at some stage you changed from being a playboy to a hard-working chap.
Well, I never did any work. It was really the Kaiser's war that saved me being sent down.
Yes.
Because I was taking a science degree as well as a medical one. I couldn't have passed anything. I did nothing but play games all the time. I played for Trinity tennis, hockey, and rugby. All of them.
All three of them?
Yeah, all three of the first as a freshman. Yes. So no wonder I didn't do any work.
You were a professor of medicine for a very long time. It must have been at least 30 years, Sir Stanley.
Yes.
And you were a successful professor of medicine. What do you think contributed to your success? With people.
And I tell you, later on, the two things that altered my whole life were, first, from being a playboy and quite a useless creature, that awful wounds that I had. I was a year in hospital, 2 years altogether, and was still very ill at the end of it. I joined the army with one kidney, a thing that nobody else would do, and nobody would be so damn silly as to do it, but it was, I just told the recruiting officer I was medical student at Cambridge and just went through without an examination. But that kidney had an awful doing with fearful pus, you know, and a wound as big as that, pouring pus for a year. And it was still pouring albumin and stuff in 1921. That's how I managed to go abroad, because the doctors, Dr. Sir Edmund Spriggs, who was a great expert on nutrition, took a very dim view of my outlook, my prospects. He told my father that it was hopeless for me to ever think of doing clinical work, and that I had to take a sort of a laboratory type of job and take it quietly. That's why I went in for pathology on medical instructions. And it was on medical instructions that I went to New Zealand on three trips to avoid the winter, because I was passing so much albumin and blood in from my one and only kidney. And so I just worked my way out on a boat as a ship surgeon and got a chap to take it back. And so it didn't cost me anything to do that, you know. Mm. The dietary treatment was to spare the kidney. It was just the same as we used to spare the liver by cutting out protein. Mm. And so they cut out the protein, and I was on a very low protein diet, not allowed to drink, which I always liked doing very much. And life was totally intolerable. And I think it was on New Year's Day, 1921 or 22, I'd reached the end of my tether. I had lost a weight to about 7 stone, and I looked awful. And I called my friends together. I said, I'd rather die than go on this way. I can't get anything to eat that I like. Can't drink any whiskey. So I bought 2 pounds of steak. I had a flat in Castle Street. And I bought 2 bottles of whiskey. And I asked 4 men along. And we took all Sir Edmund Spriggs's instructions and diet sheets to Princes Street. And at midnight, when the car stopped rolling, we burnt them in the middle of Princes Street, danced around the fire, and the bobbies came to stop us eating. We explained it, and they said, well, carry on, Ray. When the fire was burnt out, we all went back to my flat, and we ate the 2 pounds of steak, which is more than I'd eaten in about a year, and drank the 2 bottles of whiskey, and from that day I began to get better.
Good gracious. Well, and this all began from when you were wounded in the First World War. Yes. And tell me, what happened then? You woke up and... Unconscious,
I was at Cambridge at that time, yes, as a student, and we had a meeting of the class. It's an extraordinary story. We had a meeting of the class in June 1914, and we had all decided that as we wanted to be in to finish the Kaiser off, that we'd all enlist in the infantry and fight and not continue our studies. We were second or third year medical students. So the whole class did that. And you know this, by 1916, I was the only survivor of the whole class of medicine. There wasn't one alive. The life, you know, in the first 2 years of the war for an infantry officer was about 3 months.
The casualty rate was phenomenal, terrific. I believe. Phenomenal.
1 million killed on 40 miles, you know.
Yes, yes.
Well, I was very only, I don't know how I survived. I was a year in hospital with this bloody gangrene. I had months and months, it wouldn't heal. Mm. I hadn't any skin on my thighs from grafting. They'd got shot after shot of the grafting, but they wouldn't heal because of the suppuration. Awful. And then finally I went to Ireland in 1916 to a convalescent camp. And eventually I came back here in 17 and qualified. And so then went on this awful damn diet.
Yes.
Which ended up in the tram lines of Edinburgh.
Who prescribed the diet for you?
Sir Edmund Spriggs, the greatest physician in Edinburgh.
Yes, yes.
He was just doing the orthodox treatment,
yes, yes,
which was to spare the kidney.
Yes. Did they treat you well in Boulogne?
What?
Did they treat you well in Boulogne?
Oh, I was so ill,
yes,
that I don't remember a thing. And my mother and father were sent to France, which shows you how ill I must have been. I don't even remember them coming.
Yes, yes.
I was terribly ill for a year.
Perhaps you were saved by Usol.
I don't think so. I just saved my luck, I think.
Mm.
I don't think it didn't save anybody else. Every other person died. I saw them all die.
Yes.
I don't know what. It's just my... I've got an immunity like 9 cats.
This was B. Welshii.
B. Welshii, yes.
Yes.
Yes, I wrote several papers on B. Welshii later on.
Yes, yes.
Because I was a bacteriologist for 2 or 3 years.
Didn't you do bacteriology at Cambridge?
No, yes, I did. Well, I on immunity. I went to Cambridge with a research fellowship.
Yes, yes.
On immunity, yes. I went to work with Dean.
That's right. Daddy Dean, was it?
Yes, he was useless. He was done at that time.
Yes.
He'd come from Manchester or somewhere where he was jolly good.
Yes.
I got a gold medal for my thesis, and Dean had a big reputation, but by the time he reached Cambridge, he was a done old man. He wasn't interested at all.
Yes.
And it was a very funny thing. That I only found out about a month ago that the man I used to work with in the path department was a chap called Swan. Mm. I only found out last month that he was Michael Swan's son. And he came into my room from doing a post-mortem about 1925, I suppose, and he asked me to examine his hand that he'd pricked his finger, he thought. Mm. So I examined his hand. I couldn't see a sign of blood or a prick. But the trick was you used to fill the glove with water, I suppose you still do.
Yes.
And then squeeze it. And sure enough, there was a drop of water did come out of one place. And he thought he'd pricked it on the rib. Of course, in those days, there were frightful post-mortems of pasture, you know, these people dying of pneumonia with long before antibiotics. However, there was nothing to be seen and nothing to be done. And, you know, he was dead in 4 days.
Really?
The second day's temperature was 103, and the fourth, 105. Mm. He was dead on the fourth. And I only found that out and just telling Swan about it the other day. Yeah. Never knew who Swan's son.
This is Michael Swan, the former principal.
The former principal's
yes.
son?
Yes. Well, you're lucky to have survived all that.
What?
You're very lucky to have survived it all.
Oh, it's nothing to all the damn things I've had. I've survived an aeroplane crash.
Yes.
Every bit of my nose and jaws head first down. Plane in fire, and I was on fire, and the person next to me blazing all over. Yes. I mean, awful. Everything. I've had a bit of my lung removed. I've had a colon removed for cancer. Well, if it's a tumor, I don't think it was cancer, but they didn't know. I've had my prostate removed. That's a great success after being a terrific failure. Mm. Just because I was a doctor, every bloody thing went wrong. Yes. It was awfully ill after it. That's ordinary people are out playing golf in about 3 weeks.
Yes.
I've had everything. There's nothing. There's not a 6 inches of my skin without a scar on it.
Mm. Well, doctors seem to invite complications, don't they?
Oh, often.
Mm? Yes.
Very upsetting for the people because they always try and do their best and they always get... They don't really always go wrong. It's just yes. when they do go wrong, they're very noticeable.
Yes.